Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Environment, Energy, Finance, and Markets Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your resource for debate and insights on carbon and energy, policy, politics, and markets. Today's show, we're blessed to have a live studio audience here at the College of AU because we have a very special guest. We're honored to welcome the Honorable Assistant Administrator of the Office of Air and Radiation at the United States Environmental Protection Agency, Gina McCarthy. We also have today on the panel Bill Snape, Senior Counsel for Center of Biological Diversity. And Peter Glazer, partner at the law firm of Troutman Saunders. Before we get into the discussion, I'd like to ask Gina, could you take a few minutes and walk us through some of the major initiatives and efforts that EPA has been doing on the greenhouse gas front?
I'm more than happy to do that. And first of all, thank you for letting me be here. It's great to be at the university and participating in these podcasts. It's really important for you to be, for folks to be educated on these issues, and anything that I can do to be helpful, I certainly want to be, because these issues are complicated, they're controversial, and to the extent that we can fully debate these issues, I think it's to the benefit of all of us. So first of all, let me begin by just saying that I have been at EPA now for a couple of years. It's been two very interesting years. I can't remember a time, I think, when EPA's rulemaking has been more controversial than it is now. I will not take the blame for that, but I will indicate that EPA is on the job doing it what it's supposed to do. And there are a couple of tenets that Administrator Lisa Jackson has certainly made front and center in the work that we do, and the major tenets are that you follow what the law says and you follow what the science says. I think the good thing about that is our scientific ability to analyze rules and to understand the implications of those, both from the health benefits perspective as well as the cost and economic consequences, has gotten more sophisticated over time. So as we've taken on new challenging topics that range not just from regulating power plants for traditional air pollutants and into the world of carbon, the EPA has gotten much more sophisticated in its ability to understand how to do that and the ramifications of that, and understanding the intended and perhaps unintended consequences. So from my perspective, there's no better time to be at EPA. But the other interesting issue, and what makes it so exciting, is that the Clean Air Act, I think, over the past 40 years has really proven itself to be one of the most influential as well as one of the most well-crafted environmental laws that I think this nation has ever enjoyed the benefits of. It is by far the most aggressive as well as successful public health measure that I think this country has ever embraced, and I think the country embraces it now more than ever, understanding the need to tackle the public health and environmental challenges that we're facing. So one of the great things is that we've recently done a lot of analysis, and it's peer-reviewed studies that are out and have been debated and looked at for a long time, and it has really shown that over the past 40 years, the Clean Air Act has provided tremendous benefits to the American family. And those benefits have come at much greater than the individual costs associated with our rulemaking. In fact, the peer-reviewed study that we recently completed that looked at the 1990 amendments showed that the Clean Air Act amendments provided $2 trillion in benefits. In 2020, those will be the benefits. And that's over $30 in benefits for every dollar spent. So I'm excited to be here and implementing that. Now, as you all know, the administration and President Obama has been clear about this. In regulating carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases, it's incredibly important that we move forward with those regulations because of the challenges associated with climate change. But by far and away, we believe that the preferential way to do that is through legislative action. That was attempted, that did not pass. We are looking forward to Congress re-engaging in that issue, but in the meantime, through legal challenges and through rulemakings of the Supreme Court, the EPA is now regulating greenhouse gases. It is a regulated pollutant under the Clean Air Act. So thank goodness the Clean Air Act is flexible. Thank goodness we have an opportunity to look at that and apply it to a unique challenge, which is the challenge associated with regulating greenhouse gases. So let me jump into that. Let me talk about the regulations that we've done under greenhouse gases. And then if I could, I'll just take a few minutes to talk about how that relates to other regulation we're doing on traditional pollutants. Because they're clearly regulated.
Yeah, please do.
One is often a co-benefit of the other, or it can be the exact opposite. One can challenge one another in terms of pollutant reductions. So let me quickly get into to the greenhouse gas world. As I said before, Congress and the Supreme Court have spoken on this issue. Greenhouse gases are a pollutant under the law. The first challenge that the agency had was to how to apply the Clean Air Act to the challenge associated with greenhouse gases. That is when the agency developed what we call the tailoring rule, which is our ability to regulate greenhouse gases in a phased and common sense way so that we're beginning to permit major sources for greenhouse gases, but we're doing it in a way that's sensitive to the resource implications as well as to our ability to tackle those challenges in a way that didn't disrupt the economy or overstrain the resources at the federal level or at the state level where we generally permit these facilities. And so as we looked at these issues, we developed the tailoring rule, which is really a phased approach that begins with major sources first to look at how we then use more flexible approaches as we're moving down in our thresholds. And PSD, I should say, is a way of regulating major sources prior to their construction. So it's basically a tenet of the Clean Air Act to look at major sources and minimize emissions from those, knowing that we're trying to not just stop the increase in emissions, but also reduce overall the amount of pollution that's going into the atmosphere. So as a result of the tailoring rule, we have begun permitting major sources. We've actually issued 5 permits at this point, going through the entire permitting process, major source permitting process. So in case you didn't notice, the world didn't come to an end as many might have thought it would. It's going through the traditional process for permitting. We're excited about it. We think it offers opportunities for not just us to reduce pollutants, but for individual companies in the case of greenhouse gases, it means we're pushing to more energy efficiency, which ends up usually being quite significant in terms of cost savings for those facilities. Now, in addition, we've gone to regulation of greenhouse gases themselves, not just permitting. We've moved forward, if you recall, in 2010, the president announced and we initiated a light-duty vehicle rule, which manages the actual emissions associated with tailpipe greenhouse gas emissions for light-duty vehicle rules. We began with 2012 to 2016 model years. That is in effect. In fact, we are looking at certifying vehicles under those model years for the greenhouse gas tailpipe standards that we have enacted. Now, the great thing is that we were able to work with the companies themselves and develop this in a very collaborative way. We're excited about the opportunities. We're excited about the opportunities to reduce greenhouse gases. It's actually going to save 1.85 billion barrels of oil, so it helps with the national security challenges associated with importing oil from foreign countries. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 962 million tons, but I guess for you and I, it also helps to know that it also will reduce the cost associated with vehicles. So in the end, through the lifetime of a 2016 model year vehicle, the individual consumer will save over $3,000. So it's great. We're reducing dependence on foreign oil. We're reducing greenhouse gases. We're saving money. It's a good news story. Well, it couldn't help but be followed by a second good news story, which was recently announced by the president, as we've reached agreement also in concert with a number of the auto manufacturers for what we do 2017 to 2025. It continues to push the envelope. The exciting thing is that those are the years when we should see really interesting alternative vehicles coming into the system at a level where the cost associated with those vehicles should come down. Your market folks, you know that until we get over that hump, subsidizing those is a good thing. Once it's out there, the market should embrace it. People should be buying them. And we're hoping that after 2025, it's a babysitting challenge as opposed to a pushing the technology challenge. We're excited by that. That, again, is going to result in 250 million metric tons of reduction in greenhouse gases during those years, another 500 million barrels of oil. And I'm sorry, I just read the levels associated with a third rule that we have recently finalized, which is greenhouse gas for heavy-duty vehicles. So that is also a major success story. The great news is associated with all of those things, we're talking about reductions in traditional pollutants, primarily in particulate matter, which is a tremendous public health benefit. So while we're tackling greenhouse gases and beginning to tackle the challenge of regulating greenhouse gases, we're bringing along with it great public health benefits for the American public, and we're excited about that. Lastly, on the carbon front, I should mention that we have just recently announced that we're open for business in terms of reporting of greenhouse gas emissions. We have a requirement to actually have industry report annually the amount of greenhouse gases they're emitting. We've recently opened the doors to collect that information. It will be available and finalized in September to us, and it will be released before the end of the year. Again, the great news of that is we're going to have at least an initial slug of 7,000 companies reporting to us, and as a result, we're hoping that we'll point out inefficiencies in their system, in their industries, in their business, where there are opportunities for cost-effective reductions of greenhouse gases. And we have plenty of voluntary programs to help them take advantage of that. Now, lastly, and I know that I've spoken a lot, and you can shut me off whenever you want, the last thing I wanted to mention is clearly the challenge associated with greenhouse gases is not how to apply the Clean Air Act, but in general, how do we look at a different economic structure, which gets away from consumption of fossil fuels. That's what generates greenhouse gases. That ultimately is the challenge before us. And as I think many of you know, President Obama has embraced the challenge associated with clean energy. It is absolutely essential for us to look at our energy structure and to find a way to generate electricity and to generate energy in ways that's different than we have been doing that before. There are a number of strategies that he has embraced. The Department of Energy has been very aggressive in implementing those strategies that are associated with increasing energy efficiency, increasing renewables, moving away from fossil fuel generation in a way that still makes it affordable for consumers. But the challenge associated with EPA has been how do we align ourselves with that movement and consider that as we're moving forward with the rulemaking that we have in play. Now, many of you know that the agency has been moving forward to look at traditional pollutants in the power sector. That aligns itself well with the movement towards clean energy, but we haven't done it because we want to be a player in clean energy. We have done it because we are under a number of court orders to actually bring deferred public health benefits to the table that have been long overdue that prior administrations have failed to accomplish within the context of the Clean Air Act. So in other words, rules have gone forward that are required under the Clean Air Act. They have not been found lawful. We have been remanded those or vacated those or asked to redo those, and we are doing our job. And we're doing that job in a number of different ways. I would begin by saying we've recently released what we call the cross-state rule. That is a redo of the Clean Air Interstate rule under the prior administration, which was found to not be lawfully done. It was found to have traded where trading wasn't allowed. It was found to not be directly and connected with air quality reductions that were required. And what it has to do with is our obligation under the Clean Air Act, when we establish National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or what we call NAAQS, you don't just decide what those standards are and what it takes to identify those areas that are out of attainment with those National Ambient Air Quality Standards. You need to implement measures that will bring them into attainment. Those measures are not just state and local measures or federal measures, but they are measures in upwind areas that contribute to that non-attainment in downwind areas. And they are measures that contribute to maintenance of those air quality standards that have been achieved in certain areas. Now, the Clean Air Interstate Rule was a was proposed by the prior administration to take care of that issue. As I said, it wasn't found to be lawful. We were required to replace that, and we've done it with something we call the Clean Air, what's it called?
Cross-state air pollution.
Thanks. We always called it the transport rule. Now we call it CASPER.
Yep.
So CASPER, the friendly amendment. So we've moved forward with that. Now, the exciting thing about that is it's an incredibly cost-effective program that allows trading in accordance with the law. And it will actually implement in 2012 air quality reductions for certain smog-forming pollutants that will improve air quality for 240 million Americans as early as 2012. Now, we're doing that in an incredibly cost-effective way, and in a way that won't impact reliability and won't force the shutting of doors unless those facilities themselves simply were not economical to begin with. So we're very excited about it. We've moved forward. We're also moving forward with what we call the MATCH rule, which is the mercury and air toxic standard, which also applies to the power sector. And that is another rule that we've been under a court order to deliver, and that's a rule that is going to significantly reduce the amount of pollution from power plants associated with toxics. Believe it or not, power plants are the number one stationary source for air toxics, and yet up until this moment, they are unregulated for toxic pollutants, where we have gotten to every other source of toxic emissions on the stationary side. They have escaped and not been regulated for a variety of reasons. Now, I'm not suggesting that they've been seeking to escape. I'm just suggesting that they haven't been, up to this point, regulated. And there's been uncertainty that's been brought into the market associated with that. We are trying to provide that certainty, tell them what they need to do, and move forward. That rule is going to be finalized in November of this year. We have so far received more than 850,000 comments on that rule. I would claim that that is an overall record, and it would not surprise me if that actually went above the 1 million mark, which is not a goal we've been seeking. It just tells you how important these rules are and how much they mean to folks. Now, the last thing I will say is that I believe that the rules we're doing are consistent with the challenges associated with moving towards a clean energy future. I think they are also consistent with the efforts that are underway to look at how to reduce greenhouse gases and address the challenges associated with climate change. But lastly, I will tell you that we are doing those for the purpose of reducing traditional pollutants under the Clean Air Act. They're long overdue, and we're going to move those forward. So I'm excited about that, and that's just a smidgen of some of the things that we're doing right now that put us both in the spotlight and hopefully on shows like yours, where we can educate the public about the benefits associated with these rules, the thousands and thousands of lives that these rules save, and the way in which we're able to do that in a way which continues to grow the economy. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Gina. That's an instructive introduction, and I'm going to wind back the debate to one of the first points that you made. When the administration first made it clear that they thought Congress was the best person to act when it came to greenhouse gases, the view was is that EPA's efforts on the greenhouse gas front would keep pressure on Congress to do so. The Clean Air Act is certainly flexible, but there's a question on many folks have raised is how well suited is it for the regulation of greenhouse gases. Bill, maybe you could go first and then Peter. Comment on your view on how well tailored, touching on the tailoring rule, the Clean Air Act is to the regulation of greenhouse gases.
Well, Bill Snape speaking, I think it goes without saying that I strongly believe, and in fact the entire environmental community believes, and public health officials believe, that the Clean Air Act is very well suited to deal with greenhouse gases and greenhouse pollutants and some of these associated toxic pollutants that Gina was talking about. The statute is based upon sound science. It is based upon the best available technology and other types of technological forcing standards. And indeed, when Congress wrote the Clean Air Act in 1970, actually anticipated climate as one of the impacts to welfare that dirty air might have. So I think there, and we can get into the specifics as the show goes on, but I think the Clean Air Act is very flexible, is very effective, and is the perfect tool, or at least the sort of building block, to deal with the greatest environmental challenge our species has ever faced, climate change. I think the problem had started, and it's sort of a chicken or an egg, which one came first, but they both sort of reared their head at the same time a couple of years ago when the president took office, promising hope and promising change. The first is that industry had its fangs out from the get-go. There are interests in this society that had no desire to be regulated. I think the power plants, as Gene was talking about, there's a reason why they've been accepted from the Clean Air Act for so many years. They've been very politically situated to not get regulated, and perhaps we can debate that, but to me that was very clear. And the howls that we're hearing today, up until this day, of ozone and toxic air pollution that would literally save lives and add industry, and the House Republicans will have none of it. So industry was ready to go after the president from day one. The second and related issue is, I think that what some in the environmental community, and I think what the administration did with this cap and trade proposal, was that it put the Clean Air Act on the chopping block. And while I can somewhat rationally, I disagree with it, but I can somewhat rationally understand that we would substitute the Clean Air Act for this new cap and trade scheme, that just fostered more of a feeding frenzy by industry. I think there may be a lot of attributes to cap and trade, but putting the Clean Air Act under the bus, which is what occurred in that legislative debate, was the wrong thing to do, and I think sort of set the stage for some of the problems that Gina has now. I think you will see, and you've heard Gina, and Gina is transparent and Gina is tough. I think EPA is to be commended for what they've been doing. I will say, though, on some of the specific rules that we'll talk about, I think the cumulative impact of being beat up so frequently is, I think EPA has become slightly timid at times. I think they have sort of carved out exceptions. So I think that we ought to be embracing the Clean Air Act precisely how Gina stated, and when we talk about some of these specific rules, we'll see how that rhetoric has not always been borne out, that we have talked about how great the Clean Air Act is, but some of the specifics of these rules really are a little weak at times.
Peter, it's a generalization to use the term industry. Obviously, the coal and gas and various other types of interests are myriad within the energy sector. But from your perspective and the folks that you represent, how well suited is the Clean Air Act from this? Some folks have raised the point that the tailoring rule cuts against the black letter law of the Clean Air Act using a aspect of administrative law doctrine about, you know, unadministratability. What's your view if those steps need to be taken to use the flexibility of the Clean Air Act for greenhouse gas regulations?
Let me make a few points. First of all, if we're talking about greenhouse gases, then the Clean Air Act is uniquely unsuited to regulation of greenhouse gases. We know this because, as Gina said, this was not the administration's first choice. The administration wanted to pursue a cap-and-trade program. That's what we had in Congress. And they only fell back on EPA greenhouse gas regulation under the Clean Air Act when it became clear the bill legislation was going to pass. Why is the Clean Air Act not suited for carbon regulation? It's pretty simple, and we're seeing it right now. What we've had here is a regulation of greenhouse gases that started out for automobiles. That's what the initial rule was, but then it was decided by EPA in their interpretation of the Clean Air Act that once you regulate greenhouse gases from automobiles, then greenhouse gases are now regulated pollutants for all purposes under the Clean Air Act, and in particular under the PSD permitting program. That led to the problem of the fact that the PSD permitting program under the statute has certain thresholds for emissions above which you have to get a permit if you emit more than 100 or 250 tons per year of a regulated pollutant. Those thresholds were set for traditional pollutants. That's a lot of traditional pollutants. It only captures the major sources of pollutants, major industry by and large. But with greenhouse gases, 100, 250 tons per year is nothing. This building probably emits that much carbon dioxide, assuming it's heated, which it's not heated today. I'm pretty sure of that. At least not by a furnace, but if it's heated by a furnace that burns natural gas, it probably would be subject to permitting under the statute. So EPA had to do something about that, so they came up with a tailoring rule. You can already see how this starts, one thing starts leading to another, and they come up with a tailoring rule, and they say, well, I know what the statute says, but we're not going to do that. We're going to, Gina said, phase it in, but they've actually never said that they're going to get back to the statutory thresholds. So what this does is it creates legal controversy. It creates uncertainty, and into the Court of Appeals we go. And if you all are sort of keeping up on the decisions from the D.C. Circuit, you know the D.C. Circuit has tended towards literalism at this point, and I have a feeling they're going to look at the 100 and 250 statutory threshold compared with the EPA initial threshold anyway that's going to be in effect for something like 3 years of 100,000 tons and go, wait a minute, excuse me. It's interesting that Bill's organization actually initially filed a challenge on this, saying you got to stick with 100, 250. They were persuaded, I guess, to withdraw that challenge, but Bill's organization has another petition with EPA to say that you have to establish a national ambient air quality standard for greenhouse gases. That, I have no idea, and I'm sure EPA has no idea how that would be administered. If we have a NAAQS for greenhouse gases, with an endangerment finding saying we are presently having endangerment with a threat to health, we will end up with a primary NAAQS for greenhouse gases at a level below current levels. That means the entire country is in non-attainment. You can't build anything if you're in non-attainment. So these are the sort of legal questions that you get when you start going into this quagmire. We are much better off with a legislative approach, but it is very important that everybody understand the dynamics of this issue. It is not correct or even useful in the debate to go, oh, those stupid House Republicans, all those Tea Party extremists. Air quality issues in the United States have always been regional. It has always been the Northeast and the West Coast, which use relatively, comparatively little fossil fuel for energy, as opposed to the South and the Midwest that do. And those are the fault lines that were exposed in the greenhouse gas debate in Congress. Remember, in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, the Democrats had a very substantial majority in the House, and they had 60 Democrats in the Senate, and they still couldn't get cap and trade done. And you have to look that one right in the face and ask yourself why that is. Why was it too controversial, even for the Democratic senators, to vote for something like that? And it's that dynamic that has now caused this backlash that Bill was just referring to. I know Gina doesn't like this term, but it is now popularly referred to in industry right now and in business in general as the EPA train wreck. Multitude of parallel regulations all coming in business at the same time when business is struggling to figure out how to make investments. We all know the statistics, 9 point whatever it is, you know, percent unemployment rate. You all will be coming out, you know, at some point. I'm sure you're all concerned about this. No business ever hired people because somebody made it more expensive for that business to invest and hire workers. So this is some of the dynamic that's going on here. I would just say, and I can't resist saying something like this, which is that in terms of, you know, the Clean Air Act in general, the Clean Air Act is extremely complicated, particularly PSD permitting. And the area that we're in right now, that we're talking about air quality, greenhouse gases, this is a really hot area in Washington, D.C. right now. If you want to know where jobs are being created in this area, it is among law firms, policy institutes, government, in terms of trying to anticipate these regulations, commenting on the regulations, litigating the regulations, and then moving through the PSD permitting area. So we have created this massive overlay of, to me, sort of, even though I get paid based on this, it's sort of useless, meaningless, what are we doing here, sort of, why, how are we adding value to our economy as we all try to argue about this and try to figure out how to implement, and I've probably gone on too long, and I apologize.
Now, let me first give Gina a chance to respond, because there was an interesting, you raised several interesting points, both Bill and Peter, but there's one in particular regarding the train wreck of EPA, or as some people put it, EPA's throwing everything at the wall. Gina, you know, your position from your introduction and EPA's position sounds as if this is not something that the Obama administration came in and said, okay, we're just going to decide to, you know, get everything out, everything we can, but rather there are court orders and requirements, legal requirements, for you to move forward you know, in this way, in many ways, you were forced to move all these tracks forward to comply with the law. And a number of folks have said that with all that in effect, at least the greenhouse gas sides of it, many of them, beyond those that are, you know, focused on reporting and disclosure, have the practical effect of basically getting better heat rates, higher, better efficiency out of new construction or retrofits and things like that. Maybe comment on your view of kind of throwing it at the wall, and where EPA comes out.
It's I feel like a kid in a candy store. I don't know where to begin. Let me hit the train wreck issue. We've heard this consistently, and really, this is no different discussion than the Clean Air Act has faced for 40 years. It's the kind of doomsday scenario that we've heard over and over, and it's never happened. And it isn't happening with greenhouse gases. The world has not ended. PSD is complicated. Every rule we do has legal controversies. We're still doing them. We're regulating greenhouse gases. We're issuing PSD permits. Normal human beings don't face any challenges associated with that. We do. Lots of discussion, but it's happening. Now, let me talk about the power plants in particular. You are absolutely right that we are under court orders to correct all of these issues. The Clean Air Act unfortunately thought that it should treat new facilities differently from existing and that existing facilities should be grandfathered because if they were around long enough, they're definitely going to upgrade because every common sense business does that. Well, that's not how the power plants have operated. We have 70-year-old coal facilities that do not have equipment on it to control pollution that has been required for 30 and 40 years
but that are fully depreciated and printing cash for their equity owners.
Well, they make a lot of money on running those facilities, and they're the ones that are frankly most at risk if we impose common sense approaches to controlling toxic emissions. They have to make choices that they haven't been forced to make. They're highly inefficient. They're small. They can go out of business without impacting reliability. We clearly try to work with those companies, but there's no excuse for uncontrolled pollution when it's out there and it's cost-effective and it's worked and it's a leveling the playing field issue. I will say that despite the fact that we have a number of regulations that are impacting the same sector, it does not mean that each rule is blind to the other. We do not have a number of trains that are ready to crash. We have trains running all in the same direction, thinking about one another, and on different tracks. There is no train wreck, because unless you're on the same track, you can't crash. We are all heading to the same place, which is the same set of technologies that deal with the same set of pollutants and provide the same outcome, which is clean energy, cost-effective energy that will save lives, and energy that will still produce the kind of power that the companies need and families are looking for that is cost-effective. So we do not see the controversy that others are portraying. We haven't seen it when they talked about it because the world would stop, because catalytic converters were being required on cars. We would never be able to drive another vehicle again. I mean, over and over we've seen this. It just doesn't happen.
Bill, Gina has hit on a number of points on the toxic side of things, the utility MACT rule that is expected and pending. And a lot of people have raised the contention that the conventional and toxic pollutant rulemakings are the tail that's wagging the greenhouse gas dog at EPA, that the practical impact of those rules in terms of efficiency at plants, control technology, investments in those are going to have more of a direct effect on the emissions profile when it comes to greenhouse gases than EPA's efforts directly to regulate greenhouse gases as a pollutant. Your group has frequently come out and said that you don't believe EPA is doing all it can when it comes to greenhouse gases. Do you agree with the tail wagging a dog effect here?
No, and let me explain why. First of all, I agree with everything Gina just said. And this train wreck metaphor that Peter's talking about is just rhetoric. I mean, that radical group, the Bipartisan Congressional Research Service, just came out with a report this month debunking the train wreck metaphor. And in fact, it stated exactly what Gina just said, that the primary impacts of these rules on power plants will be largely on coal-fired power plants more than 40 years old that have not, until now, installed state-of-the-art pollution controls. If that's a train wreck, then, you know, let's speed up the trains, because it's something that is long overdue. As it relates to this co-benefit issue, you have to look at the actual pollutants that we're talking about and where they're coming from. Coal-burning power plants are a good example. These old power plants are emitting a lot of nitrogen oxides, what we call NOx in legal parlance or scientific parlance. And NOx not only need to be regulated on their own, they are precursors to ozone, which not only have climate change impacts but also human health impacts. So there's a reason why I think EPA is dealing with these rules first. A, they're cleaning up the mess that the Bush administration created. B, there are immediate public health impacts that they want to abate, which I think is the right thing to do. And C, it puts your foot in the water to begin the discussion and begin the regulation of greenhouse gases themselves. I think EPA is to be commended for that approach. And if anything, as I said earlier, I think they've been a little bit too timid at times. And we'll talk about how that is in a little bit. I don't want to lose the main point where Gina and I agree. Now, I do want to say one thing about Peter's introductory remarks, and he's going to get a chance right now to come after me again. So, you know, I know what I'm getting into. Peter's a very good lawyer. He represents some of the biggest...
This is being taped, right?
excellent lawyer. And we'll have a chance to go point by point on the tailoring rule, on MACT, on ozone and the like. Putting aside for a second the fact that the Supreme Court has already clearly said, the Supreme Court, that the Clean Air Act is the legally appropriate place to deal with greenhouse gases. Just putting that aside, Mr. Glaser has argued not only before the D.C. Circuit, but also before Congress, that greenhouse gases actually can be good because greenhouse gases have helped us develop and reach these standards of living that we all now have. And, you know, I think you need to step back and think about what the meaning of that statement is. I think that is a very dangerous statement. It is akin to, and pardon this childlike metaphor, but it's what has popped in my head. A dog needs to eat. A dog needs to eat its dinner. But that does not mean you allow the dog to eat the whole bag of puppy chow so that there are messes throughout the house and throughout the neighborhood. Obviously, we have developed to the point that we have through these gases and pollutants that we now know are harmful. That does not mean we just continue full steam ahead. It means that as a smart species, we take a step back and regulate these pollutants. But to hear Mr. Glaser and his some of his clients and other people in industry, and some are far more vitriolic than Mr. Glaser. He is a more, I think, tempered advocate on this argument. We all do nothing. That's the context in which this debate is occurring. I mean, we can go point by point on the legal aspects of the tailoring rule, and that would be a good debate to have. But those espousing the fact that we ought not have the Clean Air Act regulating greenhouse gases don't want it to be regulated at all under any circumstance. That's the reality of this debate. And so Gina gets caught in, and EPA gets caught in the middle, just trying to take these baby steps, and they're getting whacked at every turn.
Is that right, Peter? Is it under any circumstance, or is it under a legislative effort that would take into the very material resource politics that drive energy decision-making in this country?
No. 30-year-old coal plants, 70-year-old coal plants. What industry is running stuff from 70 years ago? What could possibly motivate the electric utility industry to be keeping online these old clunkers that don't operate all the time? They're held together with chewing gum and Band-Aids. Why are they doing that? Well, they're just trying to print money and put it in their pocket. These are regulated electric utilities. All that money goes right to the ratepayers, okay? Those plants are online because they can't figure out what else to do that will provide the round-the-clock, what's called baseload electricity, the electricity that runs day and night. They can't figure out what else to do except keep running them because there's problems with building everything. One of the things that you would expect is that they would modernize and upgrade those plants. The problem with doing that is that you trigger PSD. And I can tell you, if any of you go out and practice environmental law and get involved in this area, what your clients and business community will tell you is your PSD strategy is by every means possible, avoid getting into the PSD process. Lose all hope, all who enter the PSD process. It takes a great deal of time. EPA, I have to say this, EPA finally issued a permit after 3.5 years for a cookie-cutter natural gas clean-burning energy plant in California, the Avano Power Plant. The Clean Air Act says that permit is supposed to be issued in 1 year. It took 3.5 years and a court case with a decision by a judge who was outraged that EPA didn't think that 1 year meant 1 year. And Gina's office did a great job trying to free that up. I mean, they actually had to withdraw a delegation from a regional office. They had to sort of get into new policy about not making that permittee follow some of the new regulations, including greenhouse gas permitting, in order to finally get that permit out in 3.5 years. This is, to me, this, when you look at the economy now, when you look at what we're facing, this is a really terrible situation that we have something like that. But that is the reason why those old clunkers are operating. A really smart strategy, what business would like to do, would be to close down those old clunkers and build new modern power plants. It could be gas, it could be new coal. New coal power plants are 30% more efficient than the old clunkers. That's a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions right away. So there's a way to deal with that without the kind of situation that we've gotten ourselves into, where the utility industry is running these old clunkers that really should be retired, and I think everybody knows that.
And Peter, you're not referencing plants equipped with carbon capture and sequestration. You're referencing plants with better heat rates, supercriticals.
Yeah, and this gets into Bill's point about my argument that greenhouse gases are good to you, which is a bit of a sort of a simplification, we'll call it. The argument is that low-cost electricity is a good thing. The National Academy for Engineers, when in 2000, in the millennium, when everybody was talking about, you know, what were the big things that happened over the last 100 years, the National Academy of Engineers said the biggest thing that happened in the 20th century was widespread electrification, because electrification is the benefit for everything. So electricity, good, right? And so the concern is, if you make electricity more expensive, less affordable to people, you're going to create bad things. You're going to create people, you know, you're going to have a situation where people, and we have a lot of people in the United States to whom a $10, $20 increase in their electric bill is meaningful. That's what the argument is. That's something that has to be considered by EPA as a matter of law. But this is not an argument that we don't try to modernize. It is intensely frustrating to be in this business and look at some of these older plants and wonder, what are we doing here? How do we end up with a system where you have these incentives against modernization? Modernization is a great idea. We just have to be smart about it. Let me just add one more point here. I actually think there's a great deal less difference between the points of view represented on this panel than may seem to be the case. There is, I think, broad consensus among the business community, the environmental regulators, and the environmental community that we have made tremendous progress in reducing emissions, and we need to keep doing it. The impetus to do that didn't stop during the Bush administration. We had the CARE rule. The CARE rule was agreed to by business, by the environmental community, and obviously by the administration. They held a press conference to announce it, all together, holding hands. Everybody was ready to do that. We had a couple of special pleaders in the utility industry and the state of North Carolina that went to the court and asked for a few little changes around the margins. And the court looked at the rule and said, you can't do this. So now it's up to everybody to figure out what's next. How do we continue to make the progress that we've made in the past? All we're arguing about is the slope of the downward line. That's all that's being argued about. There's a lot of sort of yelling and screaming that goes with all of this stuff. I use the phrase train wreck. Bill, you know, talks about polluters, dirty, you know, but that's not really what the debate ought to be about. The Clean Air Act was last amended in 1990. It's getting very, very long in the tooth. It is time that we figure out a way to get an overall solution to this. Some kind of negotiated overall new legislation in the present climate in Washington is going to be real hard. But if everybody would just sort of calm down on all sides, my people that I work with included, maybe we could work towards that.
Chris, before we put it back to Gina, and I, you know, we are going in order here, sort of, but I do want to interject two very quick points, and I want to now finally try to dive a little deep on some specific points, because we've all been hovering at 10,000 feet. One, just to clean up a little debate we had. This is from Peter Glaser's congressional testimony before the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, March 31st of this year. He says, and I quote, "In the first place, EPA did not consider the societal health and welfare benefits created by the energy sources that produce GHGs." So I don't think I was misstating that. I don't think that was relevant to what we're talking about here in terms of the endangerment finding in the Clean Air Act. And you can respond to that later if you want. But let's talk about these permits. Because Peter just laid out a scenario where permits are going to be hard to get, it's going to be gridlock, it's going to add uncertainty and all these things. And Gina, you said in your opening remarks that the world has not ended. I would agree with that assertion. That if anything, things are moving pretty smoothly. And just so you don't think I'm being too cozy with Gina, I do want to criticize you on this point, which is why I'll throw it back to you. We have been critical as how you've been issuing these PSD permits, and here the basic standard is the best available control technology. We believe you've been defining the scope of these projects and these permits extraordinarily narrowly, so that it isn't just producing energy, or it isn't just a coal-burning power plant. It is a very, the way the industry is submitting these permits, it's a very specific type of filter with this very specific type of plant, and therefore they have so narrowly defined their existence, and this is based upon a Seventh Circuit court decision, that you're just handing out these permits with really no technological foreseeing going on, that you're allowing these, you're handing out the permits too freely, and you're not getting the bang for your buck out of the Clean Air Act. So that would be the criticism we have, not that it has held things up, but to the contrary, it should be holding things up a little bit more, we think.
Well, Gina, even with that clear stratification, you talk to engineers and they'll tell you no two boilers are alike, and so on. Is there still that reality that there's available and best available control technology, and other than those improvements in heat rate, higher efficiency, the kind of modernized plants that Peter was talking about, there isn't presently a commercially applicable way to scrub greenhouse gas emissions.
Oh, that's right. That's right. In terms of greenhouse gases, we're looking at the efficiency of the system, the efficiency of the facility, the efficiency of the equipment. You know, there are many ways that, you know, we looked very carefully at how to apply, obviously, the Clean Air Act to greenhouse gases and to how we would look at best available control technologies. I would tell you that I think, Bill, you'd probably disagree with the way in which we do best available control technologies for traditional pollutants as well, because we're doing the exact same thing with greenhouse gases as we do with traditional pollutants. We respect the project that is going through the permit process. And if it's being proposed as a coal facility, we review it to get it the best coal facility it can get. And there are many that would disagree with that strategy. The one thing we really didn't want to do was to look at greenhouse gas as being significantly different than other pollutants. And if there is a court case or a challenge that changes our mind on how to do that, we will certainly respect that. But the one thing we didn't want was to somehow go outside the box of the law as we understood it and the decisions that the courts have made. And we tried to respect that. I think it's driven some very good decisions as a result. And I think the decisions that will hold the test of time in terms of court challenges. But the only other thing that I would say is that I don't disagree with Peter, that I don't think we're all far off about where we want to go. And the fact that with the Clean Air Act has worked tremendously for 40 years. There are always challenges with that. But the only thing I would say, and I think where we have a fundamental disagreement, Peter, is my job is to apply the law as it currently exists. to look at the science as it currently exists. It's not to step back and say, well, let's hold off on implementing the law because I really wish Congress would look at it slightly different and give me a different tool. I have what I have. And the fact that the president would have really liked a larger, more comprehensive response to what is essentially an extremely large problem that society as a whole needs to struggle with. He didn't say, but plan B, there is no plan B. We shouldn't think of the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act applies to greenhouse gases. I can't wait around for the market to develop itself. And frankly, I reject entirely the assertion that coal facilities are running because the market is demanding them. And they wish they didn't have to be old and ugly with no controls. There has clearly been a strategy by many really good power companies to invest in those facilities and bring them up to date. There are old facilities today operating that beat the pollution that is being emitted by 20-year-old facilities because they've invested in them. There are just other companies that have decided that those investments would make that facility profitable and they'd rather run it and make the profits. If we don't tackle this issue now, which the Clean Air Act is mandating us to do, when are we going to do it? How long are we going to defer public health improvements that the Clean Air Act has been demanding for 40 years. In the instance of power plants, we are at least 20 years late. And if you look at just the cross-state rule alone, which is just looking at upstream emissions, we are with this one rule providing 120 to 290 billion in annual benefits, public health benefits to people. That's 34,000 premature deaths avoided. That's 15,000 near-fatal heart attacks, 19,000 cases of acute bronchitis. Should we continue to do that while we wish Congress would change the law to make it easier? Right now, we have coal facilities running while natural gas facilities are sitting there idle in that same area. It is not a reliability problem. They are not being drawn on because they're efficient. They're being drawn on because they're cheap, because they don't absorb the cost associated with 34,000 deaths, with asthma attacks for kids. That's what the Clean Air Act is supposed to do, is close that loop and make those connections.
Gina, Peter, and Bill, one of the challenges faced is that those benefits and the cost-benefit analysis take multiple years to be able to manifest. Similar to the greenhouse gas vehicle rule, where there's some initial upfront cost to it, but over the life cycle of the use of the vehicle, it comes out net positive in terms of the increased efficiency. Is one of the challenges that you're facing, and some folks have said that this has something to do with the delay in the industrial boiler MACT rule, is one of the challenges that at this point in the economy right now, it's more difficult for us to make a investment that returns over the next, 15 to 30 years, is now a difficult time to ask for that upfront capital when the economy is in the situation it is?
I think that, I've been in this business now for 30 years. Whenever the economy gets difficult, my life gets much more difficult. That's the way that it works. And we need to explain ourselves. And the one thing that's great about the work I do is we follow the science when you're setting standards. We look at the economic consequences when you actually implement those standards. The Clean Air Act isn't oblivious to economic consequences. And what I would say is right now we have a power sector that I think by all accounts needs to have investment made. We are falling behind in terms of keeping up with our energy infrastructure, and utilities actually want to spend money. The spending of this money that's associated with our rulemaking will actually create jobs. It will spur growth in that economy. The problem is that while they're looking for certainty about where to go, they just don't want the answer to be that is going to be disbeneficial more to certain companies than others. That's not my job. My job is to apply the law, to apply the science, and to take into account those economic consequences. But what I will say to you is that we look at jobs, we look at the economy. What I know is that when we did the analysis associated with the mercury and air toxic standard, what we saw from that was an actual spur in jobs of 17,000 jobs will grow as a result just associated with pollution control equipment. And what we saw, there'll be 9,000 long-term jobs associated with that. So we believe that we can be sensitive to these issues, we can grow the economy, but we really, first and foremost, have to do what Congress told us to do. And that's implement the law.
But before we go to student Q&A, Peter, Bill, you guys want to chime in on that same question?
Yeah, let me try to make a response, just on a couple of things. First of all, you have to understand how we got to where we are today. The 1990 Clean Air Act amendments effected a radical change in the way that power plants were treated. We went from command and control technology to a market-based cap and trade system. The theory of market-based cap and trade system is that you make the pollution control installations where it is most cost-effective to do so. Those are the plants that reduce. They overcomply. That generates allowances that they can sell to somebody else that will not comply. That was the whole scenario. That's why we have plants out there that have not been brought down to the pollution control levels of the plants that overcomplied. In order not to come down to the level of these other plants that overcomplied, the plants, the uncontrolled plants, paid money. That's what they did. That was the whole theory of the way all of this worked. You pay money to somebody else to overcontrol, and we will keep that slope of general air pollution going down, down, down. That's how we got to where we are today. It is just disconcerting, I think, to be accused of, you know, you're laggards. There's good guys that have done the right thing, and the bad guys that haven't done the right thing. But this is the way we set the system up to operate. As I said, business, by and large, is ready to take the next downward step to keep that progress going. But it is just not very helpful to try to classify this into, you know, good guys and bad guys. I also want to say, Gina, just personally, I understand that EPA has to apply the law. And so I get it that, you know, you come into office and here is this sort of laundry list of consent decrees. You've entered in some new consent decrees that we might have disagreed with, but you need to do, you know, what the law requires. Can't wait around sitting, you know, waiting for Congress. I also have to say, though, and this is not meant as criticism, for those of us who are getting truly alarmed about the state of the economy and what's going on in the country, I do think that it is incumbent on people who work in the administration to be more proactive on if we need a legislative solution, then we need to go do that. I know maybe that's you're very busy doing what you're doing, and we all respect that. But we have a situation right now that just calls out for some kind of compromise, some kind of let's just try to sweep away all of this useless argument and come to an overall agreement on how we're going to do it. I mean, I know that I think that the benefits that you've enumerated are overstated, and we don't have anywhere near enough time to get into any of that, and we don't have to. We don't have to because, like, as I said, there is general agreement. Let's keep the downward slope on emissions. Let's keep it going. But we have to figure out a way to do it that doesn't disproportionately impact some people and benefit other people.
Bill, is now the time in this economy?
Yes, and I'm going to make three very succinct points before we open it up to the student questions. The first is that Gina implied, and I think she mentioned it in the earlier part of her discussion, and I think even Peter was alluding to it, although we would maybe not agree on the specifics, but the reduction of healthcare costs, the actual, I don't like talking about people's health and monetary terms, because to me it's more sacrosanct than that, but I am the son of a father, the grandson of a doctor, but my father and grandfather, the costs that we are saving by having cleaner air are immeasurable. So I think that absolutely has to be into this mix that Peter's talking about. Secondly, I would make the more grandiose assertion that we are in the economic times we are precisely because of deregulation, in this case the mortgage banking crisis, which is far beyond the scope of this panel. But I have not seen any aspects in history where by regulating too much we have caused problems. The problems have usually occur when we don't regulate enough. That is what I would assert. And then lastly, just perhaps maybe one of the students will pick this up, the red meat I would like to throw into the ring as we finish up this this podcast is new source performance standards. We all, clean air practitioners, all very aware of the centrality of that provision in the Clean Air Act. Gina, we won't go into the litany of the rules that you're in the midst of finalizing, some by court order, some by not. But we would like to urge you in the environmental community, as you're looking at these NSPS, for short, coal-burning power plants, oil refineries, natural gas systems, cement factories, to not only deal with conventional pollutants, but to deal with methane, to deal with carbon dioxide. I mean, methane is 21 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. If we capture it, it actually can be used for economic benefit. So far, what we've seen is EPA not riding that NSPS horse as hard as it could. And we think that would have environmental and economic benefits. So that's, I will leave my concluding remarks on that note.
We'll be... Why don't we jump to student Q&A? I'm sure there's some folks in the audience who have a question or two for the panel. And if you're interested, please come up to the mic and don't be bashful.
And make sure you tell us who you are. That's the practitioner in residence here at the law school. I want to know, I'm proud of our law students.
Hi, my name is... I don't know if it's on. My name is Chelsea Tu. I am a second year law student at American University, Washington College of Law. I have two questions for Ms. McCarthy. First one is kind of a side question regarding the mandatory reporting of greenhouse gases rule. How is the agency, the EPA, enforcing the greenhouse gas reporting from large greenhouse gas emitting facilities? You could explain that a little bit more, that'd be great. And the second question, I know that you've touched upon in your discussion so far, and I would like to just ask Ms. McCarthy for a little bit more explanation of EPA's stance on this. So my question is a little bit larger, policy-based. Many GOP members have vocalized opposition to the EPA's new plans on regulating GHGs, greenhouse gases for large stationary sources of emission, specifically saying that the EPA is hurting business, especially given our current state of the economy. In fact, legislation such as the Energy Tax Prevention Act have already passed in the House and is going on to the Senate. So how has the political animosity towards the EPA's new rules on greenhouse gases impacted the EPA's actions towards setting and implementing these rules?
Thanks, those are good questions. Gina, maybe hit on the greenhouse gas reporting rule first, and
sure.
Get a chance to speak maybe a little bit about the delay in the reporting deadline.
The mandatory reporting rule actually came out of another congressional mandate, it basically required EPA businesses to begin to report greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gas reporting, this is not new. It's been happening on a voluntary basis for quite a while. There are folks that are out there that verify greenhouse gases, so there are protocols associated with that. The challenge for us was that we have identified that we will begin with facilities that generate 25,000 tons or more a year. That's a hefty amount of businesses across the country in a number of different sectors. So we have spent time developing a number of rules which design the protocols associated with counting greenhouse gases. And how do you monitor them? What assumptions, what emissions factors do you use? And we've been slowly cranking through those. There was a delay in the reporting for a couple of reasons. One is it was a larger task than we were able to accomplish in a short period of time. There were also concerns about confidential business information that we needed to resolve, because the reporting is public reporting, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't crossing lines that would be difficult for business and certainly make it difficult for us to continue. And the large issue is we had to have an electronic reporting format and database available, which is what we've recently announced is the availability of that database so that we can manage this in an effective way. The idea is that that information would be publicly available to folks. You'd know where greenhouse gases were being generated in your own community. You could work with companies to identify ways in which you could structure like energy efficiency programs that different states offer to help support reductions in areas where they may be most beneficial. So it's a good program. I do think we've learned from the toxic release inventory the power of public information. And this will actually build on that to generate momentum for reductions that we don't individually regulate, which is great. Unlike Bill, I actually like market-based approaches. I really think they work well, and I hesitate to say that as a regulator, but I think regulations only belong when there's market failures and when there is a need to interject prices associated with societal prices. That aren't reflected in the market and don't work well. And that's where I think I struggle to make sure that that's the case and we look at it closely. In terms of EPA, your second question really had to do more with the overall criticism that EPA is, well, they like to say job killer and stuff like that. I think in general EPA has great support among the general public. People know we're there to protect their public health and environment. I think we've shown ourselves to have reasonable approaches to how to do that, to look at what the most cost-effective approaches are. We're applying those same kind of can-do attitude to the rules that we're doing, regardless of the fact that we're under some extreme timelines. So I really feel like the public looks at EPA as having scientific credibility. We've seen that between 70 and 2009, the economy has grown, by leaps and bounds. At the same time, we've had significant reductions in major pollutants. So we know how to do this. We'll apply that same attitude as we move forward.
Thanks, Gina. We have another question from the audience.
I am Diego Alessandro Romana Riva. I am a LLN student. My question is for Mr. Peter, you talk about the willingness of the power plant industry in order to modernize their facilities and maybe provide the services in a better way. I would like to know what steps, concrete steps, are they undertaking in order to achieve those goals, in order to modernize their facilities and produce a better energy, cleaner energy at least.
Every utility system in the United States right now does something that's called integrated resource planning. This is something that's done in conjunction with the Public Utilities Commission. The utility here in Washington is PEPCO. We have a DC Public Service Commission. And they get together and plan out the system. As a part of planning out the system, they try to come up with a future plan for serving the public that basically has three legs to the stool. One is keeping costs affordable. The second is reliability, meaning keeping the lights on. And the third is improving environmentally. All three of those things are balanced together. So what we've seen as time has gone on, the 90s, the 2000s, that a lot of the new development has gone towards either new modernized coal plants or new modern natural gas plants or wind or solar, and a great deal of emphasis is being put on energy efficiency. The energy efficiency stuff that's going on is very interesting. Electric rate growth in the United States, which has been historically averaged around 2 or 3% a year, has basically stopped. There's no growth in electric demand going on right now. Now, this may be, and as a result, greenhouse gas emissions went down, although they came back in 2000 with the economy. It's hard to tell whether or not electric rate growth will continue to grow once the economy comes back. But you will see over time. I mean, eventually these older plants will close. But you will see over time, you know, increased efficiency. This is just sort of the way the world works. This is why I try to make the point of why is it that we have 70-year-old plants out there? Why? I mean, it's not anywhere else in the economy that you see something like that. I just think that you all have to understand that there are pluses and minuses to everything. We had a big dash to use of natural gas in the United States in the 90s. Natural gas prices went through the roof. Consumers were hollering, yelling, screaming. We got to the 2000s, and it was like, well, I guess we ought to build coal. Wind and solar, you have to understand, are what's called intermittent resources. The wind blows when the wind blows. Even in the most windy areas of the country, you can only count on wind about 40% of the time, and mostly that's not during the peak part of the summer. When it gets really hot, you have less wind. We're not going to have solar, really, in any significant quantity here in Washington, D.C. It's just not a sort of sunny area. We'll have some. Solar's 1% of electricity. So, I mean, maybe this is all not very satisfying, but, as Gina said, emissions are going down over time. As the economy moves, we continue to modernize.
One point I'll make, adding on to Peter's, is that, you know, the combination of load-following resources like gas with renewables can help the combination of resources that are not a traditional baseload resource be able to perform closer to what a baseload resource would. The other thing I'll highlight, because I think Peter makes an interesting point that we actually have discussed in past hot air shows, which is where policy has been tracking to. We moved from looking at cap and trade, regulation of the pollutant itself, and if you look at what some of the proposals are in Capitol Hill now around clean energy standards and such, you're seeing Congress and in a lot of other parts of the country, and this is evidenced by renewable portfolio standards and so on, moving more towards the nature of the generating resource, the character of the resource itself, as opposed to setting a threshold on the emissions performance of the resource. And time will tell how those efforts pan out and how the two various tracks interrelate. Before we wrap up, I'm going to ask Bill, can you take maybe just a minute and give a closing statement? Peter, give a closing statement, and then we'll let Gina say something before we end the day.
Thanks, Chris. First of all, I'm much more optimistic on renewables than I think I just heard Peter be, although I think he was making a narrower point. I mean, here just in the District of Columbia, there are people who have a zero rate pay every month because they put solar panels on their homes' roofs, and they're paying off those panels within the course of 6 to 12 years. So I actually am optimistic about renewables, including solar, even in the District of Columbia. Secondly, we have not talked about the larger administration here. We've talked mostly about EPA because, of course, Gina McCarthy is here, but I am concerned about the role that OMB in the White House now in some of these rules. I'm very concerned about what they're doing to the final ozone rule that I hope will be out soon, which will have not only great public health impacts, but climate benefits as well. And I think that's a piece of the puzzle that needs to be thrown out. Gina and the administrator do their work, and then the bean counters go to work at OMB, and I think that's problematic frequently. And I'll just lastly leave you with direct quotes from House Republican members about EPA, because it defines the climate, no pun intended, on how Gina works. These are four quotes, and I will tell you a House member who spoke that quote. Quote number one, the scariest agency in the federal government is the EPA, an agency that has lost its bearings. Mike Simpson, Idaho, Republican. Second, the epitome of the continued and damaging regulatory overreach of the administration is EPA. Harold Rogers, Republican, Kentucky. Both those two members are key members on the Appropriations Committee, and Rogers on the Energy and Commerce Committee. A West Virginia Republican, Shelley Capito, the out-of-control regulation authority of EPA. And then last, and perhaps my favorite, because it just smacks of a lot of things, EPA's regulatory jihad, John Micah, Florida. You hear those words, They're power packed. They have meaning beyond just the economic debates and regulatory debates we've been having here today, and I think it makes EPA's job much harder, and thank you, Gina, for all you do. Even though I criticize you, I know you've got a lot of work to do, so thank you on a number of levels.
And that meeting might have a little something to do with politics and ideologies and so on, because you hear vitriol on both sides of the debate. One interesting observation I'll make before we throw it over to Peter and make a closing statement. Peter's point about demand staying flat and load not bouncing back after the recession, your point about increased opportunities behind the meter, energy efficiency and renewables, this I think is part of a trend that we're seeing that is really taking load from being something that's looked at as a utility program, an aspect of the utility business model, and beginning to treat load increasingly like an asset. And that's evidenced by increased demand response, the vast increase in energy service company engagements and like types of deployments wherein people are beginning to say, wait a minute, this isn't just a cost point. The way I manage the way I use energy is an asset in and of itself that can be deployed. And it'll be interesting to see how far that actually plays out as we go into the future. Peter, a closing statement on the conversation?
Let me just say, I just want to reiterate something I said earlier. The beginning of wisdom on this topic is to recognize that there are different points of view on this and that not everybody agrees with the way the administration is proceeding, but doesn't make them a bad person, right? You can't start with that. You have to get out of Washington and talk to people outside the Beltway to understand what's going on. As I said earlier, the administration started with 60 Democrats in the Senate and a big majority in the House. There was a reason why cap and trade didn't go through, and it wasn't because of a couple of Republicans that somebody wants to classify as some kooky Republicans. That's not what's going on. There are real economic impacts of these rules, and it's got people very concerned and very scared about the future. You cannot understand this issue without understanding how scared people are given the current economic situation. We now have almost 20% of the country long-term unemployed. That's a very frightening statistic right now. And when you talk about new regulations that are going to increase costs, it frightens people. And if you can understand that and understand that the people who represent those people need to be dealt with in trying to come to compromises, then we will work our way out of the situation that we're in. It is not helpful to go, if only the really dumb, stupid people would just go away, then we could get this solved. I mean, I'm not trying to sort of go overboard on what Bill said, but it is frustrating to understand that we went through 2 years with very large Democratic majorities and a bill didn't pass. And you have to understand why that was. That's it.
Well, that's two great perspectives, from the left with Bill Snape and from the right with Peter Glaser. Gina, take a minute or two and why don't you close us out here?
Thanks, Chris. First of all, it's great to be here and listen to the debate. And it's not often that I actually play the role of being in the middle. Usually I'm on one end of the spectrum or the other when we talk. So it's great to be in the middle. And frankly, I think I probably am in the middle. My job is to implement laws, not to critique them. My job is to understand the policy implications of those laws. My job is to understand what the mission of the agency is and what we're intending to do and how to get there and how to do it in a way that does recognize, I think, the legitimate issues that Peter's raising. There is no question that people are concerned about the economy, and EPA needs to be as well. Nobody has said anything different than that. And I think our job is to recognize that, to find ways of communicating with industry, of not putting black hats and white hats on people, but making steady progress, which is what we've done for a long time. You know, the challenge that we have is that there is this public health benefits on the table, which should not still be on the table. And we have to find a way to continue to move forward and do it in a way where we convince the general public that we're doing what the law says and what the science demands. That's our measure of success, and we think we can achieve that. And we think at the same time we can make sure that the economy can grow. We can make sure that we're sensitive to the overall concerns of the president and everybody in the United States about job growth. And we have to be concerned about that, and we will be. But that doesn't mean we stand still, and that doesn't mean we can ignore what the law requires, and that certainly doesn't mean that we reinvent the science. We'll just do our job.
Well, thanks, Gina. As someone who works in the development and financing of generation and efficiency across the full spectrum of technologies, you know, much of this debate in the time period we're in right now comes into whether do you call it a cost or do you call it an investment? And that really is based on your individual's decision, which manifests in your power bill and your energy bills, as to what you think the country's payback period and internal rate of return on our collective energy use should be. And with that, on behalf of everyone involved in bringing you the Hot Air Show, thank you for listening. And look forward